Okay, right, welcome everybody. This dealing with difficult emotions retreat. Before we really get started, I'm just going to explain a little bit about what we're going to be looking at overall over the next couple of mornings. The title of this obviously is Dealing with Difficult Emotions. So we're particularly going to be focusing on the psychology side of Buddhism, really. There are all sorts of aspects really to the Buddhist teachings, but psychology is a very, very important part of it. I mean, you could say everything we do in Buddhism, one way or another, really comes down to transforming our mind in a positive way, the way we think, the way we feel, the way we react to things, the way we interact and help others. It's a very, very important subject. But in order to present this, what I'm going to talk about primarily today, the first day, is a teaching called the Four Noble Truths. This is the most fundamental teaching in Buddhism, really. According to all the major Buddhist traditions, this was the first teaching given by the Buddha. After his enlightenment, it is said that he was traveling around a little bit after his enlightenment in Bodhgaya. And he came to a place just outside Varanasi, which is called Sarnath now, the deer park. And there he met some spiritual practitioners who he actually knew, who he'd been working with before he actually became enlightened. And he gave them this teaching on the Four Noble Truths. Everything that we study, practice, apply one way or another in Buddhism really relates to the Four Noble Truths. It gives a very, very good framework the Buddhist teachings as a whole. We could spend the entire retreat just looking at this. We could spend the year, we could spend our entire lives studying the Four Noble Truths. I mean, there's a lot to them. And of course, we're just going to look at it in brief today. But it gives a really, really nice framework, I think, for the rest of the stuff that we're going to be looking at. We will also, later on today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Buddhist understanding of mind, the nature of mind, and the relationship between mind and matter. And that's basically going to be the main subject today. Tomorrow, we're then going to look a bit more specifically at the practical application of Buddhist psychology, and particularly how we can apply the teachings to reduce negative things like anger, like jealousy, like depression, things like that, and how we can nurture positive things like loving kindness. And then at the last session tomorrow, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's called thought transformation, or Lojong in Tibetan, which is looking at ways that we can use difficulties in life and problems and situations in a very, very positive way to help to apply our practice. So that's briefly what we're going to be looking at as the course as a whole. There are going to be lots of discussion sessions. And I would really, really encourage people as much as you can to relate this to your actual lives and your daily experience. If you're not, some people are more comfortable opening up than others like that. So don't feel any pressure like that. You know, we're all different. But it can make it a lot more real and a lot more practical if we do open up and really, apply this to things that are really happening to us, obviously, in our lives. But before we do that, we're going to start with a little bit of meditation. So I'd encourage everybody to get comfortable. I'm going to really talk us through this. I suspect some of you are very used to meditating, but to other people this might be quite new too. So the first thing that's important is we get ourselves nice and comfy. As I said at the start, it doesn't matter if you're on a cushion or on a chair. The most important thing is you're comfortable. I mean, you can meditate lying on your back if that's more comfortable. Although a lot of us find if we do that, we tend to get drowsy, so I wouldn't encourage that. It's better to sit. Whether you're on a cushion or whether you're in a chair, First of all, check that you've got a nice firm base. Feel the way your bottom's grounded to the cushion or the chair. It's particularly important when we're meditating that we have a nice straight back. And there are good reasons for that. It's partly just comfort. If our back isn't straight, then we're always kind of working against gravity, having to use muscles to stay straight. But if your back's straight, gravity's working for you. That's one reason, but it also has a bearing on the way that subtle energies move around the body. And these are related to our state of mind. So it's very, very important as we're doing this, we don't force anything. It's all in a nice, relaxed way. But just imagine that your vertebrae are a pile of pound coins. Stacking up, starting at the bottom. One on top of the other. And what could also be helpful is now imagine that somebody's just tugging at the top of your head very, very gently, just like a piece of string. And again, without forcing anything, just very, very gently pulling up, just slightly stretching your spine, just very, very slightly. And then relax back into the posture. Having checked the top back's nice and straight, let's move our attention to the lower part of our body. Check that you're nicely grounded against the chair or the cushion. Make sure your legs are nice and comfy. Particularly important you're not cutting off the circulation anywhere. Check that. If you're meditating sat in a chair, some people find it helpful to put a cushion under their feet just to raise their feet slightly. And that's something you have to check just depending on your body shape. Again, your legs should be nice and relaxed. And then we'll move our attention to our arms and our shoulders. Make sure that your arms are nice and relaxed. Again, you can find what works for you, but two ways of doing that are either to put your hands on your knees, palms down, or to place your hands in your lap, palms upwards, one on top of the other, just with the thumbs touching. Just see what works best for you and what's most comfortable. And make sure your shoulders are nice and relaxed. A lot of us have a tendency to hunch our shoulders a bit, so just push them back very, very gently. Again, without forcing anything, that's really, really important. Okay, just relax into the posture. Now check your head and your neck again, that they're nice and relaxed. Roll your head around a little bit if you find that helpful initially. Just stretch. The head ideally should just be tilted forward very slightly. Make sure your jaw is nice and relaxed. It's one place we can hold on to tension sometimes. Make sure that's really nice and relaxed with the teeth just coming together. But make sure you're not clenching them. It's good to place your tongue, the tip of your tongue, just to the roof of your mouth, just behind the front two top teeth. It's purely a practical reason that it's otherwise saliva can build up in the mouth and that can be distracting. Again, it should just feel nice and relaxed and natural. Now check that your eyes are nice and relaxed. Again, the eyelids should just be coming together ideally. So your eyes aren't either completely closed or completely open. There's just a little bit of light coming in. Some people do find that distracting though. So if you're more comfortable, it's okay to close them. All these points I've just covered are basically what's usually called the seven-point posture for meditating. I won't be going through this every session or every meditation session we do. It's a good thing to do before we start. It's really important before any meditation practice. Able to get ourselves nice and comfy. Relaxing the body is a very important step before we move on to the mind. And there's a little meditation manual that I sent out with the materials which you can all have access to for the course resources. That contains all those points here. There. The most important thing is we're nice and comfy. And as I said at the start, we've got a nice straight back without forcing anything. Now we're going to check if we're holding on to tension anywhere. And we're all different like that. I mean, I tend to hold on to tension in my stomach. My stomach tenses up a little bit, for instance. You might find that somewhere else. And just check, go through all the different parts of your body. Start at your toes, work all the way up. And just check if you're feeling tense anyway. One thing that can help from that is if you just breathe in deeply, just imagine that you're breathing out into that part of the body. Just letting the tension very naturally dissipate away. Okay, we're now going to do a practice called mindfulness of breathing. Again, if you look in that meditation manual that I sent out, it explains that there are two basic types of meditation that we do. And this is just speaking very, very broadly. The first type is sometimes called stabilizing meditation. Purpose of which is mainly to develop concentration and mental clarity. And this practice, the mindfulness of breathing, comes within that category. There are actually lots of objects we can use to help to stabilize the mind. But the breath can be particularly effective. For one thing, it's always there as long as we're alive. But there's also a relationship between our breathing and our state of mind. So in a nice, relaxed way, again, just turn your attention to the natural rhythms of your breathing. Notice the subtle sensations as your diaphragm moves down, drawing in the air. Notice those subtle sensations as the air enters that point of the nostrils, goes down into your lungs, then again as your diaphragm pushes back up, expelling the air outwards. And go back up. Again, notice those subtle sensations at the nostrils. Yeah, leaves your body. Just sit with that for a few rounds. We're now going to hone our attention down further. That point at the nostrils. Noticing the subtle sensations as the air enters and leaves the body. And just let yourself breathe naturally. And just watching it. Try not to force anything. And we're going to hold our attention at that point at the nostrils, noting those subtle sensations. If you notice you're becoming distracted, discursive thoughts, memories, thoughts about what we're going to be doing later, so on, I'll start coming in. Don't worry about it. It's very, very natural. There's no success or failure with this kind of practice. You just go with it, see what happens. But as soon as you notice you're distracted, don't feed or follow those things. They'll wait till later. Just remember what you're doing and just return your attention back in a nice, relaxed way. Again, to that point of the nostrils. We'll just do that quietly for a few minutes. when you're doing this practice on your own, it can be really, really good once in a while to remind ourselves of the benefits and why we're doing it. This kind of practice is the basis of a lot of people's mindfulness practice, which is, of course, particularly popular at the moment. And initially, it can be a very effective way of helping to reduce stress, calming us down. That's very, very important. In the long run, if we keep persevering with this kind of practice, we can do a lot more than that. It can help develop mental clarity and concentration. And that will enormously enhance all our other practices and daily activities. It's just one facet of the Buddhist path, but it's a very, very important part. Just think how great it would be to have a mind that's clear, calm, totally concentrated. So we can really devote 100% of our attention onto any chosen activity. With that in mind, just return back to the practice again, noticing those subtle sensations. The air enters and leaves the body at the nostrils. Just hold your attention, and again, without forcing anything, in a nice, relaxed way on that. Enjoying those subtle sensations. As soon as you become distracted, as soon as you notice, again, don't worry about it. Just notice it. Just place your attention back at that point of the nostrils. Again, we'll do that for a few minutes. Now, just for the final part of this meditation session, we're going to really turn our attention to our motivation for being here today. Okay, and having a good, strong, positive motivation is very, very important before we engage with any activity. With the best kind of motivation we can have, according to Mahayana Buddhism, of which Tibetan Buddhism is a part, is the aspiration to become enlightened so we can be of the most benefit to help others. And along the way, that also very much involves sorting out our own problems. Let's reflect that we're here not just to help ourselves, although that's very, very important, and that's certainly part of it. It's also to put us in a better position to be able to truly help and benefit others. Okay. I would advise people generally, particularly if you're new to meditating, that if we're doing any kind of meditation practice, it's always good to start it with a little bit of that on the breathing. As I said during the session, a lot of people find that very, very helpful in reducing stress and so on anyway. But it also can really help to calm down the mind and get us more concentrated. So it really helps to enhance whatever follows. And it's always a very, very good way to start any meditation practice. Another bit of advice I'd give generally about that, and particularly for people who are quite new to meditation, it's better to start short. I didn't when I started. I mean, a lot of us get very, very enthused and try and do very long sessions, and the enthusiasm tends to wane over time. Do that. It's always good to start short and then build up, and it becomes easier and easier to build it up. But particularly if you just do sessions of 5 or 10 minutes and try and keep that up on a daily basis, you'll find quite easily you can build on that, and it becomes your habit then. Okay. So now I'm going to start and introduce the Four Noble Truths. As I explained briefly at the start, this is probably the most fundamental teaching in Buddhism. Generally accepted to be the first teaching that the Buddha gave after his enlightenment. And obviously, I'm just going to give a very short overview of it here, but it does provide a nice framework for everything else we're going to be looking at over the next couple of days. Now, the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, as the title implies, there are four truths. And these are the truth of suffering, the truth of the origin of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And that they're the four. It might be helpful, Faye, if you put that overhead up actually now, just so people can have a refer to that as I'm talking. Thanks. That's great. And you can see it's at the top there. Before I start explaining them, I'd want to say a little bit about the word suffering, because I think this can be quite emotive for a lot of people. And it's actually a translation of the Sanskrit word dukkha. And it's nearly always translated as suffering, so I'm going to use that. But it doesn't necessarily get across the broad connotation of what the word dukkha means exactly. Usually when we say suffering in English, it's got a very heavy kind of connotation. And dukkha does include that. It includes all the things that we'd normally identify as suffering in English. But it's also much, much more subtle than that. It can include just being a bit bored, for instance, or a bit irritated. You might find my voice irritating. That would come within dukkha. Yeah, but it's not something we'd normally call suffering in English. A term that's sometimes used is unsatisfactoriness, but it doesn't sound very good, that does it? You can see why the translators tend to pick the word suffering. But what it's really talking about is just problems and difficulties. It is an acknowledgement that unenlightened existence comes with problems, and we all experience problems. And there might be somebody here who doesn't ever experience problems, but I doubt it very much. It is part of the human condition to experience problems and difficulties, as long as we're unenlightened. And in Buddhism, it's broadened beyond humans, of course. It's all living beings, one way or another, experience problems and difficulties. But I will mostly be sticking with the word suffering, but do bear that in mind, because it includes everything. I mean, it can include really things like intense pain and grief and loss and things like that that we normally call suffering. But as I say, it can include just minor irritations and things like that as well. So bearing that in mind as I'm talking about this. And I'm going to talk firstly then about the first one, which is the truth of suffering. And as you can see on the handout there, this is actually broken down into three levels. The suffering of suffering, which sounds tautological, but I'll explain that in a minute. The suffering of change and pervasive suffering, which is sometimes called the suffering of the aggregates. And these get more subtle as we go along. The first one, the first level, is the suffering of suffering. And this is very, very easy to spot. These are things that we've just naturally and intuitively identify as undesirable, the kind of experiences we naturally want to be separated from when we encounter them. As I said, it can be very, very subtle, though. You know, sometimes when you meditate and you get that little pain you might get in your leg or something like that. And a lot of the minor sort of things that bug us as we go through our day and the irritations, you know, that we all experience as we go through our day, that's all included within the suffering of suffering. But then it goes all the way up to obviously really, really serious problems to do with illness and loss and grief and so on. That obviously we know are going on around all the time, even though we're not personally encountering that level of course, all the time. And that's the first level, and that's the easiest one to spot. The second level, which again, if you look on the handout there, is called the suffering of change. And this one's a little bit more subtle. This applies to experiences that we would often identify as pleasurable or desirable. But the problem is that we tend to cling to those things in a way that is at odds with their impermanence. And that, because of that clinging, that also brings problems. When those things are no longer there, or they're taken away from us, it leads to problems, you know, within our mind. And that's the suffering of change. And that one's a lot more subtle. I think it's really important to say, though, in relation to that, that in no way is Buddhism discouraging us from taking joy and pleasure in things. It's extremely important that we do take pleasure in things. And in fact, I think as most of us will experience, it's important to keep ourselves mentally and physically healthy, that we take pleasure in enjoying things. And in fact, if we're able to experience things without getting too attached and without clinging to them, it actually opens up a space to enjoy them more and to take more joy and pleasure in things. Just to give some examples of that, of the suffering of change, I mean, one obvious example is, say, suddenly when the weather all gets really nice and the sun comes out. You walk outside, everybody's smiling, everybody's really happy about it and loving it. If that goes on for a few days, it doesn't take that long before some of us start whinging that it's all too hot and it's getting a bit hot. So that's kind of one example, a great example of this offering a change. You know, things don't lead to permanent and lasting satisfaction. And as long as we're aware of that and we work within an awareness of that impermanence, it's fine and we can enjoy things as long as we don't expect them to bring that kind of lasting happiness and satisfaction. I mean, another example of that, Sarah and I, for instance, I mean, for the last 18 years, we lived somewhere that was really, really spectacularly beautiful. We were very, very fortunate. We actually managed a small property for the National Trust, and we got a house that came with the job, and it was particularly beautiful, beautiful place. And we loved that, and we enjoyed that very, very much, and we appreciated being there. Due to circumstances beyond our control, recently that was taken away from us due to the National Trust reaction to COVID, and we suddenly had to move out, and we were made redundant. At the time, that didn't feel very, very nice, and it was something we had to work with. It was a very, very good opportunity to apply Buddhist practice. But the problem there is getting too attached and expecting things to last. We can't expect things to last forever. It's good that we took enormous amount of joy and pleasure out of being there. But again, there was a certain amount of attachment. And of course, that inevitably caused some sense of loss, you know, when that was taken away from us. But there are many, many examples of that. And I'm going to be encouraging us to discuss these things at the start of the next session. So bear that in mind. If you can identify where perhaps we cling to things too much. Impermanence is generally a very, very important concept in Buddhism, and we're encouraged to meditate and reflect on impermanence a lot. And impermanence in Buddhism goes very, very deep. It's not just the idea that things don't last forever. It's that things are changing all the time, momentarily. And that applies to everything. It applies to physical reality, and that's absolutely backed up in the more deeply we think about that. You know, we can link this up with science, and the more deeply we go, particularly if we get down to the level of particles and the quantum level, everything is in flux all the time and continuously changing. It applies to our bodies. Obviously, we're all aware that we're aging. We don't necessarily live in accord with that. I mean, I'm at the sort of age now where I sometimes look in the mirror or look at a photograph of myself and I'm slightly taken aback and I think, who's that? I've still got this image of myself 20 years ago. And it's again reflecting on the impermanent nature of reality and living more in accord with that is very, very important for our happiness. So it's very, very important idea of impermanence. And that's the suffering of change. But as I say, just going back and repeating, it doesn't mean that we don't take pleasure in doing things. It's really, really important that we do. Yeah. But as long as we don't cling to things too much and expect them to last forever, or bring really, really lasting happiness and satisfaction. And then the third level, which again, as you can see on the handout, is called pervasive suffering. This is sometimes called the suffering of the aggregates. This is the most subtle one, and this is the really, really important one that the Buddhist teachings, the more deeply we go into them, is really trying to address. The best way I've had this explained to me is to think of it in terms of the potential to suffer, or the potential to experience problems, which is with us all the time. Things can be going great. We can be really, really happy. We can be really, really calm. We can be at peace. Suddenly things change, again, due to circumstances beyond our control, and then problems come again. I think that's something we all experience. And that potential is always there. It is possible for the first two levels of suffering, and again, we're going to be looking and talking about this later, to temporarily subside, and we're not experiencing those. But until we've really addressed the next noble truth, which I'm going to get to in a minute, which is the truth of origin, there's still always that potential. So we're always it comes with a kind of vulnerability that we all have. And again, as I say, I'll be encouraging us to discuss this later on in the next session. So just bear those three, two levels in mind. Again, the suffering of suffering, which is really obvious problems, things that we identify as problematic and undesirable. The suffering of change, which is caused by that tendency to cling to things in a way that's sort of obvious with their changeability, with their impermanence. And then this pervasive suffering, which this is this potential, this kind of vulnerability that's kind of with us all the time, due to an enlightened existence itself. And that moves us quite naturally onto the next one, which is the truth of the origin of suffering. Now, if we actually identify the causes of any given problem, any difficulty we might experience in life, if we really, really think of it, there's an entire myriad of different causes and conditions. And again, this is something we're going to be discussing. I think that's self-evident. And you know, if we take any situation, there's a whole range of both internal and external causes. There are things that are going on around us, the way people are treating us, the way perhaps certain objects, the way our computer's behaving. And it could be things that are going on in the political world, obviously things that are going with the environment. There's a whole myriad of external causes to problems and difficulties. But of course, there's also a range of internal causes, which is all due to our mind, due to our feelings, due to the way we're reacting to things. Very, very important idea in Buddhism is that whenever we're experiencing a problem or suffering, the really fundamental cause, the root cause, is always within our own mind. This can initially be quite difficult to take on board. But if we think about it, it's actually very, very liberating. Because our ability to control external conditions is limited. Whereas we can definitely do something about our inner attitude, the way we react to things, the way our thoughts and feelings arise in certain situations. That's something we can definitely affect and do something about. Now, you have to be careful how you apply this, and you have to be realistic. And that's very, very important. Also, a very, very important thing I'd say to that is if you're helping other people and they're experiencing a problem or difficulty, if they're going through something that they're finding really problematic, telling them that the root cause is within their own mind probably isn't the most effective way to deal with it. It's possible if you know the person very, very well, if you know they're a Buddhist practitioner, it might be appropriate to do that. But generally, that isn't probably the best thing to do to help somebody else, you know, when they're actually going through a problem or difficulty. So first and foremost, we have to take this on board ourselves. But again, we have to be realistic, and it doesn't mean that external things don't matter at all. It's very, very important that. If people are treating us unfairly, for instance, sometimes it's absolutely right to stand up, to stand up to that. And Buddhism, again, this is something I'll be revisiting more than once as we go through the course. It does not encourage doormat syndrome and letting people treat us like crap. That can be very, very damaging. Yeah. So, and also, and there are lots of other ways in which obviously we can affect external causes. I mean, things like the environment, obviously, and in a lot of the actions we do in helping others. So it doesn't mean that external things don't matter at all. And where we can, we do what we can to improve external conditions and things. But the real root cause, the fundamental cause, is within our own mind. And to overcome suffering, this is what we really have to work on from a Buddhist point of view. How are we doing for time? Okay. Can you put the next handout up, Faye? That's H3. Hi, Faye. All right. Lovely, thanks. Now, this chart just shows very, very simply from a Buddhist point of view. This is explaining what's really at the root, from a Buddhist point of view, of that potential to suffer that's within each and every one of us. As long as we're enlightened, this is the point. We can change this. If we couldn't, this would all be quite depressing. But this is stuff we can change. Now, the real root cause, from a Buddhist point of view, that's at the root of our problems and difficulties is ignorance, which you can see at the start of the chart there. Now, ignorance in this context is very, very specific. We usually, when we use the word in English, ignorance, it's probably, I mean, it tends to mean sort of just not knowing stuff and not knowing things, but it's not here. It's much, much more specific than that. It's sometimes described as a case of misknowing. There is a fundamental discrepancy between the way reality appears to us and the way it actually exists. Most particularly, we have what's called a reified or exaggerated notion of I. And that's of the self of being something more fixed and permanent, more inherent, more independent than is actually the case. And it actually doesn't just apply to the I, that it applies to everything, all phenomena. Things appear to be more fixed, independent than they actually are. In reality, everything exists interdependently within the flow of cause and effect. You'll hear the concept of emptiness talked about a lot. And what that means is that things are empty of that kind of solid, fixed, independent, inherent nature. In reality, things exist, as I say, interdependently within the flow of cause and effect. And that flow of cause and effect, it can be looked at very, very subtly, that it doesn't just mean physical causality, though that's part of it. It also includes mind and consciousness. Now, analysing that intellectually isn't actually that hard to do to arrive at that understanding. But from a Buddhist point of view, even if we know that intellectually, generally, we're not living in accord with that empty and interdependent nature. There's a strong sense of an I here, solid sense of an I, and a separate world out there. And it creates this false sense of separation between self and others, between other people, other beings, and between the rest of reality. And as from a Buddhist point of view, that's really what's at the root of our problems. As a result of that, which if you move on to the next bit in the chart, it says they're reflective emotions. The real root ones are self-centered attachment and aversion. We're going to be looking at attachment quite a bit, actually, and particularly tomorrow, because people quite often mix up attachment with love, but it really isn't. We're going to have a look at that tomorrow. But attachment is obviously a desire to have things, not to want to be separated from things. But it involves an exaggeration of a given thing or person who we're attached to, its ability to actually bring us lasting happiness. And it's very much in accord with that ignorance that I just described, attachment. Aversion is similar, except it's the opposite. It's a strong wish to be separated from things. And again, it has that exaggeration of a thing's ability or a person's ability to harm us. And these are what are really at the root of all our problems and difficulties. Generally, in daily life, what we actually experience, that we're talking here, very, very subtle levels of the mind, and much grosser levels of this. So if you look at something like anger, for instance, that's related particularly to aversion. It's an extreme form of aversion. I mean, something like greed is an extreme form of attachment. But these three, ignorance and attachment to aversion, are really at the root of all those other problems that we generally experience on the surface in our daily lives. And if anybody's familiar with the Buddhist Wheel of Life image, there are three little figures in the middle of it, in the hub in the middle. There's a pig, there's a cock, and there's a snake. And they actually represent, well, those three, which are called the three poisons, which is ignorance, attachment, aversion. And as I say, that's what gives rise to all our other problems and difficulties at the deepest level we're talking about here. Later, we're going to be looking much more at how we can practically deal with these things on the surface, things like anger and jealousy and so on. Now, in turn, just following the chart through, as a result of that, as a result of ignorance, attachment, aversion, we then carry out actions which can either be physical, mental, or verbal. And this is where karma comes in. Now, karma can be either positive or negative. Here, because we're talking about the root causes of problems and suffering, we're talking about negative karma. And basically, actions are considered negative in Buddhism, and there's no sort of sense of judgment of evil or that kind of thing in Buddhism like this. It's just a practical way, really, of looking at cause and effect. And they're actions which can either be a body, speech, or mind, which lead to problems and difficulties for either oneself and others. And in turn, that then leads to problems, which is obviously where the chart there concludes. Okay, Faye, I think you can put that down now. Just go back to me, thanks. Okay, are there any questions based on anything that I've just explained? We're going to have a break in a minute. And please don't be shy. If there's anything you want to bring up that you think's relevant to that.
Susan, do you want to ask a question? If you unmute yourself, please.
Yeah, it was about the karma. So, you know, when we come back and we have to do what we've learned. But what I'm thinking was, if you're doing things in unawareness throughout your life until you, like, the light goes on and then you start thinking, oh, well, maybe I haven't done things the right way.
Yeah.
So are we still affected by that karma, even though we've done it in unawareness? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It's a great question. No, thanks for that, because it's really, really important, actually. Yes, we can we are affected by it, even if we weren't aware when we did it. I mean, karma involves intentional action, but there are lots of levels of intention, and intention can be very, very subtle and subconscious, really. So we are still affected by it, but that doesn't mean it's written in stone and we're stuck with it. Because if we all of us have right now, we're experiencing the results of both positive and negative karma. There's a lot of positive karma. I mean, the fact that we've got the opportunity to do this, you know, for instance, and there are lots of other things in our life. But we are definitely affected, and our mind is affected by negative actions in the past. But we can change it and do things about it. And there are no exceptions to that. There's a very, very famous Buddhist practitioner called Milarepa who'd murdered people within that single lifetime. And he still managed to purify that within that lifetime. Ways to do that. I'm hoping we might have time to talk a little bit about purification practice. There are specific practices we can do within that are taught, say, within Tibetan Buddhism, practices like Vajrasattva and prostrations, Nyungne retreats. These are just ideas that we can do that are very specifically aimed at purifying negative karma from the past. And it's just helping, really, to get rid of that negative effect it's had on your mind stream. But it doesn't have to be stuff like that, and it doesn't even have to be in a Buddhist KM context. I mean, things like voluntary work, for instance, just doing acts of kindness can actually help to overcome the negative effects of those things in the past. So the answer to your question is, yes, we are affected, even though we weren't aware, but we can do things about it to improve things moving into the future. Is that helpful? Does that answer it?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, say from childhood and things happened in your childhood that you had no control over. So that them actions affect the actions as you get older. So you do things because you've been affected as a child or whatever, right?
Right.
So is that the same thing? If someone else has done that to you?
Right, yeah. Karma is involved with all of that from a Buddhist point of view. If you look in terms of past and future lives, I mean, definitely karma is involved, but you can definitely change it from this point. Is that what you're getting at? I'm not quite sure what you get.
I'm just trying to find out the my own karma, how I was born, and then how another person's karma, right, can affect me as a person.
Other people's actions can affect you, but it's only, you're only really responsible for your own karma. You're not responsible for other people's. We are generally encouraged in Buddhism to think in terms of when things are happening to us, to kind of take responsibility for it and think it's my karma. But what we have to be very, very careful of that is that there's no sort of question of deserving it or anything like that. It's just a question of taking responsibility and doing what we can from this point. We all, from a Buddhist point of view, have karmas that could ripen like that at some point, you know, with people treating us unfairly. And in some cases, I get the feeling, are you hinting at something much, much worse than that?
I'm just thinking if things happen to you in your childhood that you have no control over, right? And then that karma, whatever has gone on, like I've been told, or I don't know, I've been told or that I, like the person has wanted that. Do you know that karma to heal or something?
Sorry. Can you, what person are we talking about?
Right. I've been told and that when we come back, right, the next life, the reason we are in the life we have, is because we chose it. So we chose our parents, we chose, so say like childhood trauma and stuff, we chose that.
I'm not sure what you mean by choose.
Like we came back into the, back into this life to learn something.
I think it can be a very good way of looking at it, that, but mostly in the way rebirth is generally explained, it's not like a really conscious choice like that. It's not like you're sitting and thinking, right, I'll choose to be reborn there. Most of us don't get that option. But we are kind of propelled into that particular rebirth as a result of karmic imprints. But it's not really choosing in that very, very conscious way like that. A lot of this is going on underneath the surface at a subconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
Is that addressing that? I think the really, really important thing with what we have to avoid with karma is thinking that people deserve to suffer and things like that. I mean, it can be a problem, say, if there's a big earthquake or something like that and lots of people are affected by that.
Mm.
And it can seem, if karma's applied uncompassionately, is it as if sort of somehow, it's their karma and they deserve it. And that can apply to people who suffer things in childhood as well. It's not like that at all. It's not like that at all. It's really, really important that we don't think of it like that.
Mm-hmm.
Karma is involved, and it's good if we can try and take responsibility. But karma really is all about that. It's all about trying to take responsibility instead of trying to move up and blame others and other things for our problems and to move on from that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are quite difficult issues, I think, you know, what you're raising there. And karma is very, very subtle and complicated, all the workings of karma.
Mm-hmm.
But in that sense of choosing, yes, this life is considered to be as a result of karmic imprints that have come through from past actions. I mean, that much is true. But it's not. And it's a good attitude to think that okay, well, I've been, you know, put in this life to learn certain things in this life. But there's no external agency involved here. It's just the workings of love, of cause and effect.
Okay.
And it's very, very important, and not to use karma in any way for sort of blame or anything like that. I mean, that's very, very important, both in relation to yourself and in relation to others. I don't know, is that helpful at all?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, it's time for a break now. I'm sorry, I've run over by 5 minutes. I do have a bad habit of doing this. So sorry, you'll have to bear with me.